I'll have a few questions for you in the beginning. The course is also open for people who just want to audit the course without getting any grade or credit. So my question is, who of you is taking the course for credit? Okay, that's about 5 people or something. Okay, because many of you are not attending for credit, it might make sense to somehow treat you separately, because the way I want to grade this is to expect some project work. So every 2 or 3 weeks, you have to hand in an assignment. I'm going to allow pair work, and we'll have to find some time for you to present that in some way. So it might be good if you could stay on afterwards or contact me by email, and then we can hash out the respective details. So in this course, I'm going to make it very practical. It's not theoretical. So we're going to use the Julia programming language for the respective work. And before I start advertising Julia, I also want to make sure that you all have access to Julia. So there are basically 2 ways you can do that. One is to install it on your own laptops. And the other way would be to use our HPC system Symmetry. And for that, you need an account. Can I get a quick show of hands? Who of you has Julia already installed on their laptop? 1, 2, 3, 4, okay, very good. So who of you is then interested in using it on Symmetry, which I would recommend? Okay, so if you have not used Symmetry before, your account needs to be set up. It takes about 2 or 3 minutes. And I asked Ishan from the help desk to be here. So if you have not used Symmetry before, I ask you to just come forward right now and have your account set up. And the first part of the lecture will then be a bit informal while you're getting ready. Who wants to be first? Yep, Tim. And I didn't mention it in the announcement, but it's usually a good idea to bring your laptop here to the meeting, and then you can follow along as we go on. I assume you all have access to the webpage where all the details are handled, so I'll skip that and try not to be too boring. And instead, let me give you a brief run through how to access Symmetry to run Julia there. So to go to a webpage, that's always difficult. Let me type it in. Can you see that? You can't, right? Because if you make the screen bigger, the title bar doesn't get larger. So it's https://, and then symmetry.pi.local. If you have your laptop today, can you just type that in and see whether it works? And then when you log in for the first time, I'm already logged in. Hey, I should probably log out, then I can show you how to log in. Log out, does that work? Yes, this is the page that you should be seeing. It asks you for the parameter password and for your username. And if it works, then you see your home directory on Symmetry, and you have not logged in on Symmetry before, then Ishan might need to help you to get set up there. So on this page, there is I can make that larger. There's a button on the top right called New. And since we're going to use Julia, you can, hey, Julia131 is here. Thanks, Dustin. You can juice the Julia here and get started.
See if it actually starts.
Yeah. And then once it started, you can do a calculation here. So if you write late, don't worry. I'm just showing people how to get started with Julia here. So the first 20 minutes of the lecture will be quite unstructured, and as people get started with getting access to Symmetry. Apparently, the kernel is still starting. I'm still waiting.
Oh, you probably have to do the package build iJulia thing beforehand, right?
I do.
Yeah. Oh,
okay, how do I do that? Can you remind me? We probably should show people, right?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay.
And under new, do a bash. Oh, yeah, okay, sure.
Bash?
Or terminal at the bottom.
Okay.
Actually, yeah, you know what? It's better to do the terminal.
Okay, I'll do the terminal. Okay, sorry, there's a step that I missed because I already got set up. Now I have to spend 2 minutes figuring out how to get started, and then I can explain to you how to get started for the first time. This is really something that only needs to be done the first time. Yes?
What's our username and password?
It's your Parameter Network account.
Because it doesn't work.
Okay, if it doesn't work, then you probably need to talk to Ishan here from the help desk in the front to get you set up. There are probably 5 people or so in the room who need their account set up. You can just do that in the beginning of the lecture here. So I go to terminal, and then...
Yeah, and then so go with module load Julia. Oh,
Oh, me too.
It's not as usual, right?
It doesn't work.
If you say so.
And then what? Update.
Okay.
Oh, I need to install in Julia.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Are you all able to log in to Symmetry?
Yes.
Okay. Very good.
Oh, we have to tell them to ask you.
Do
we choose head nodes?
Yes, you choose head node. Very good. Good question. Head node is the easiest. The other thing is this for advanced users. What?
Is it still not working?
I don't know. I was annoyed because I typed it into the title bar. That's not a good idea.
Do we go to Julia on your page after?
Okay, it works. Okay, now updated instructions. Okay, after logging into Symmetry, if that works for you, you are in this view here. This is your home directory on Symmetry. If you're logged in there for the first time, you have many fewer files. The first thing you do there is go to New and Terminal down here. Dustin, do we have instructions for this on the web? We will by tomorrow, I guess. Just remind me if I forget. And then here you have to type a magic thing, GM shared.
No, not us. Wait, what thing you want to get here? Oh, spoon. Yeah, just try again.
Okay. In the terminal, you have to type this long path name. Apologies that the instructions are a bit rough. I forgot to prepare this part for the lecture because it already worked for me because I'm using Julia. So I'm already get tripped if someone uses Julia for the first time.
So if we already have Julia, we don't need to do
This is the first time you're using Julia on Symmetry, you have to follow the instructions. But it's just the one-time setup. And in the future, it will just work.
Sorry, what were those instructions again?
You don't.
And you have to open a terminal. When you log into Symmetry, you see your home directory.
Oh.
You open a terminal, which gives you this black window, and then you have to have to type this long path name there, CM shared, and so on and so forth.
Okay. Thank you.
CM shared apps Julia, Julia 131, or whatever version you're using, being Julia. You see a nice picture like that. You probably do not see these warnings here, and then you type closing square bracket, which turns the prompt into blue, and then you type add iJulia, and hit enter, and then after a minute or so, you should be set up. So after you installed iJulia, you go to this page and say new, and then Julia, choose the same version number that you started for, started earlier, 131, and then you get a Julia window, and then as first instruction, you probably want to type something like 2+3 or something, 1+1, something simple, and see where that calculates. And the first time you type something into Julia, it will take a few seconds because the kernel needs to start, and then you see the result. Okay, let's begin. So I decided that we should use the Julia programming language for this course. The other contender for the language would have been Python. I think Julia has a few advantages over Python. One of the advantages is that Julia is for certain tasks faster than Python, and that is in particular useful when it comes to scientific computing. to linear algebra and so on. There's a web page for the Julia language called julialang.org. You can go there, and at the very top, there is a lecture advertised. So the Sidney Fernbach Award is a prestigious award that one of the founders of the Julia language won last year. He gave an acceptance speech, kind of a keynote speech, and you can watch it on YouTube. And it's quite interesting to see what he thinks about the language Julia, why it's an interesting, why it's an important language, and what features about Julia are good and are unique, are not found in other languages. And I mentioned that Julia is faster than Python for certain tasks. Another advantage of Julia is that it is a strongly typed language. Types play a more important role than in Julia, and than in Python. I want to explain it like that. Python was designed about 20 years ago. At that time, object-oriented programming was en vogue, and Julia is a more modern language. People realized over the past 20 years that object-oriented programming is not all that sufficient. There are certain things that are, I'm confused in how I explain that. The thing is, if you have a large-scale program, it's very easy to make certain kinds of mistake. And what helps you remove mistakes is actually have a language design that's much closer to the language and notation that we use in mathematics. In mathematics, if you define something, you say, let x be 2, then x is 2. And it's not 2 until you change it. It just is 2. You write, let x be 2, and then below in the calculation, x always has the value 2. And it's not that 2 steps into the calculation, x changes the way to 3, which is what you would do in a computer program where you can change values all the time. So the modern programming paradigm is that as often as possible, you define things, and then you keep it constant, and you don't change it. And that's not really object-oriented programming. That's more functional programming. And Julia has that baked into the language a bit better than Python. And in Julia, it is also easier to define types and to declare data types. And a type is essentially a constraint that you impose yourself. For example, you might have a function. You say, oh, one of the input parameters of the function should be a real number. And if you make a mistake, the compiler will catch that. And in other languages, the language might say, oh, you're passing in a complex number, but see, the imaginary part is really small. Let me helpfully convert that to a real number for you. Or you might pass in a string, and then the compiler might say, yeah, it's a string, but let's try to reinterpret the string as a real number. See, that makes sense. And then you get the real number in that. So 20 years ago, people were thinking, let's be helpful to the programmer. And these days, the mantra is, people make mistakes. So the compiler should be a barrier between you and your mistakes. So they're trying to avoid these kind of mistakes. It makes programming a bit more tedious, but it points out errors. And in the end, I think it's quite helpful. So I want to give a quick run through to Julia, the programming language. I typed 2+3 here. If Julia is working for you, you can follow along. If not, I'll make the notebook available later on, and you can then follow on later on. And of course, there are many online tutorials for Julia as well. So if you type a number, for example, 2, 2 is 2, of course, you can ask, every object in Julia has a type, so you can say type of 2, and it says 2 is an integer, here a 64-bit integer. And instead of integers, there's of course also real numbers. There's type of 3.0, that's a 64-bit floating point number. And of course, Julia has other types as well. For like strings, type hello, that would be a string. And if you add an integer and a real number, the result is going to be a real number. And if you add an integer and a string, of course, this does not work. This kind of addition is not defined, so you get an error message. In addition to these scalar types, of course, you have also arrays. So for example, if you write 1, 2, 3, you get an array of integers. And if you write 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, then you get an array of real numbers. And Julia has multi-dimensional arrays. In Python, this would be NumPy arrays. In other languages like C and C++, they don't have multidimensional arrays built in. So you can type 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is then a 2x3 matrix that you defined that way. And the same way, you can add integers. You can add arrays, 1, 2 plus 3, 4 yields 4.6, and you can also multiply arrays, 2 times 3, 4, is this, and you can also do a pointwise multiplication of arrays. 1.2 dot, I think, is the syntax, gives the multiplication. You can define arrays, say arrays of random numbers, rand 3,3 gives a 3x3 matrix of random numbers. B equals rand 3 gives a vector of 3 elements, and you multiply them exactly the way you expect. You can invert the matrix with inf. You can multiply matrices. Ha, I need to define B first, but let's multiply A by A. The inverse of A times A gives the identity matrix. It has 1 on the diagonal and 0 on the off diagonals, and a 10 to minus 16, that is the floating point error that you get, because the built-in 64-bit floating point numbers, they have only about 16 bits of accuracy. Julia has a bit more linear algebra built in. Julia has a module system. There are only a certain number of functions available by default. If you want more functions, you have to load the respective module. You do that via using. So for example, using linear algebra. And then you can, for example, an eigen decomposition of the matrix I. Okay. It now took 3 or 5 seconds to do that eigen decomposition. That's, of course, not 3 or 5 seconds to the eigen decomposition. It's 3 or 5 seconds to load the module or compile the code and so on. The actual eigen decomposition probably was done in less than a millisecond or something. And since it's a generic matrix of real numbers, the eigenvalues and eigenvectors are complex numbers, and that's what the IM means. IM is the imaginary unit in Julia. And we can also do an eigen decomposition of a symmetric matrix A plus A transpose, so that the backtick, the apostrophe after A, is the transpose operation. Then this is now a symmetric matrix, and it turns out the eigen decomposition routine checks for that, and then it returns real numbers. Up here, you see as a result complex float 64, that's complex floating numbers. And down here, the result is just float 64. That's just real numbers that you're getting here. And there is also a singular value decomposition that you can do, which gives you always real numbers, the left and right singular vectors that come out. I assume that what I'm showing you so far is a bit boring for most of you. Most of you might just get stuck with the syntax of Julia. If you know other programming language, then it's always the decision whether you square round brackets for arrays and things like that, and what the name of the routines are that do the eigenvalue decompositions. This is always covered in tutorials. A quick show around might help you. Julia can also do some plotting. Let's add a plotting package. The linear algebra package was built in, so we were able to just use it. Other packages you need to add, you need to install before you can use them. So I'll hit the square closing bracket and say add gadfly. Gadfly is the name of a plotting package that I like to use. There are several plotting packages. I'm sure Dustin will use a different one at some point. And now we need to wait until that package has been downloaded and installed and compiled. And then we can do a plot. Look at all the things it installs for plotting package. This is amazing. If I'm going too fast, you can stop me at any time.
Sorry.
Yes?
Why for the linear algebra using and this it's add, what is the difference?
Oh, using just makes it available if it's already installed. Add means install it. Oh. So every time you want to use linear algebra, you have to say using before. This adding is only something that I have to do once. And since I'm using the Julia version for the first time, I have to add it. You'll have to add it. But then from now on, I have to never add the package again.
But now I would have to use, if I
still have to use using. This add kind of downloads it. This is the big expensive operation. And using just brings it into the namespace so that the commands are available.
It's using like import in Python.
Pardon?
It's like import in Python.
Yes, exactly. If you say conda install, that's the add here. And if you say import in Python, that's the using here.
Sorry, what's gadfly for?
It's plotting, making plots. And there are other plotting packages as well. There's a wrapper for matplotlib in Python. Many of you know that and can use that. I think it's called pyplot in Julia. You can also do that. I'm using gadfly today, but anything is fine. Yeah, so apparently this gadfly package depends transitively on about 100 other packages. Amazing. Okay. So using gadfly. And now it's pre-compiling it. Pre-compiling means it's faster. So one of the advantages of Julia is that it's faster than Python for certain operations. Faster means then in Python the code is interpreted. In Julia the code is compiled. Of course, compiling means the first time you use the code, it needs to be compiled. So the first time you type in a command, Julia is actually much, much slower than Python. But if you're doing something with big matrices in the end, depending how things are defined, they can be much faster in Julia. So I'm seeing a lot of output here in the JupyterHead notebook. I don't know whether you know the trick, but if you click on the field here on the left, you either see all the output or you only see the first 10 or 20 lines of the output. That makes it easier to scroll. And as soon as the star here is gone away, I know that I can use the package.
Does Julia have any of the symbolic manipulation of Mathematica?
So in principle, the core of Julia is based on Lisp, very similar to Mathematica. And there is a package for Julia where you can do something, but it's not as advanced as Mathematica. So in principle, it should be possible, but the push from the Julia developers and from the community is in the same direction as MATLAB. It is numerical calculations, not symbolic calculations. But you get the same thing that you get in Mathematica, that you have expression trees and can do all these things. It's just the useful things with replacements and pattern matching. It's not as convenient to do that in Julia.
What is new in the new version of Julia?
In the new version of Julia? I think in this version 1.3, one of the new things is multithreading. There will be a lecture on multithreading and code parallelization later on in, I don't know, 6 or 8 weeks or something, because that might be interesting if you want to get fast code, if you want to use all the cores of a machine. But at the moment, that's not interesting. So I think in the first 6 lectures or something, it doesn't matter which version of Julia you're using. It's still precompiling, yeah. So when people say Julia is much faster than Python, that's the thing. It actually needs to compile something. That's actually a known problem with the language. They call it time to first plot, because when you install and build a plotting library, that takes a long time. And the developers are aware of that, and there is now a push to alleviate the problem. I think so far what they identified, it's the optimizer that makes the thing run fast that actually takes a lot of time. But if you have a plotting package, you can't actually optimize it, because you need to put the pixels on the screen and there's nothing to optimize. So the optimizer apparently goes crazy, trying to optimize and doesn't find anything. And in the end, it takes a long time. We are there, very good. Let's plot something. Rand 20 gives a vector of 20 points. I'm plotting something, I'm giving the x and y coordinates of 20 points. And that should give a plot. I'm using it the first time, so this is now the third time turn is slow, then it's faster. And then you should see a plot with 20 random points.
Just wait, it'll be really fast.
Okay, no, plotting is not really fast, but if you actually solve the Einstein equations or something, you code them up directly, that would be possible in Julia, Fortran, C, C++, and so on, but it would not be possible in Python. In Python, you'd have to use NumPy or a C extension or something. I don't want to overestimate, over-advertise the speed of Julia, because we were all stuck here. But I hope that in a few minutes I'll get to show how to use the type system in Julia, how to define your own data types. And once we are there, this is the other advantage that Julia has over Python. Okay, while we're waiting, I don't know whether you've programmed before, but the first thing that people do is that they type a lot of commands into each of these cells here in a JupyterHub notebook to do something. And one of the first abstraction barriers that you encounter, if these cells become too large, 10, 20 lines or something, is to define functions. You need to break up the cells into smaller pieces of work and need to actually define a function that you can use later on. And the second abstraction step that people need to learn is that if you're always passing the same things together, right, x, y, and z arrays for points or something, you need to find a data type for that that nicely packages things up and that makes functions then easier to use end to end. And I hope these will permeate the course so that in the end you have a bit of a feeling how you break a code into functions and how you break variables, how do you combine them into types that makes code easier to use and easier to reuse. Hey, look, while I was talking, there's the plot, 20 points.
What plot function takes so long?
No, it's the first time. If I hit it again,
only the first time.
There you go, it's right there. It's because it was compiling the plot function. Before it was pre-compiling it and then compiling, I don't understand the difference. I don't know that, whatever.
So packages is only the first time you pre-compile them. It takes so long.
Yes, the first time and the first time to compile it.
Okay. So long.
Scaling issues.
That's really
so let's create a histogram. This is geom that histo bin count equals 100. I hope I get this correct. So I'm drawing 10,000 random numbers and drawing a histogram, binning it into 100 points. Mm. Ishan, are you still helping others out? Okay. If you're good, yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for stopping by. That was really useful. So now we have 10,000 points, and the standard deviation could be, well, sorry, no, we have 100 bins, and the standard deviation could be 10. That looks about right. And of course, 10,000 random numbers, you need to find out what random number distribution. Let's call rand n, and then you see what happens. Then the histogram actually looks different. Yes?
What is geom?
What did he check?
So here, that geom, when you plot something, then of course you have different things. You have the actual data that are plotted, and then actually the way the data are transformed into a plot geometry, that is then called geom, so it's part of the plot command here. The geometry is a histogram, is what this means. And then, of course, you have several attributes. You have the labels that you can put, and x-axis and y-axis, and so on. So if you want to learn more about that, then you need to go to the plot package, Gadfly, and find out how to plot something. There are different plot packages. If Gadfly doesn't suit your taste, then you can use a different one. So apparently, if you have regular random numbers, you get a uniform distribution between 0 and 1. And if you call rand n here, then we get a normal distribution. And apparently, the maximum and minimum that we found from random numbers this time is somewhere around minus 5 or plus 5. If we do a different one, then you might get a different extent. No, the same extent again. Okay. Since you asked, I can also show you how we get the syntax tree or something similar in Mathematica. So how does this work? \m. Yay! That was markdown to add a comment into the notebook. So if you write a function 2 plus 3, it is evaluated, but you can also keep it unevaluated. You can quote it without evaluated, and that means you add a colon in front of it and put the expression in parentheses, and the result of 2 plus 3 and 5, but the result of 2 plus 3 as syntax tree is that the kind of the abstract expression 2 plus 3, the same way as in Mathematica, or you can write, right? You write x plus 2, you get an error, x is not defined, but if you treat it as an expression, then of course just get the expression x plus 2. If you do this in Mathematica, it has lots of simplification rules that are fire automatically, that are applied automatically. None of that exists in Julia, so this is what I meant, it's more difficult. But in principle, you can do that as well. Yes?
Do the kind of sections.
What kind of sections?
Like where your accessories are.
Yeah.
This was? Yes. I type escape M, and then I am in markdown mode. You can also go to cell, and what is it, cell type? Yes, and cell type can be code or markdown. If it's code, it's executed. If it's markdown, it's just something else you can do. So in principle, you can write your talk in here and have large sections of text that you put in here. And markdown is the same format that you use for readmes in GitHub or something. It's basically text with a bit of titles and formula and so on. Hmm?
Why might this be useful to like write an expression that's not evaluated?
Because then you can do algebraic transformations in the expression. For example, in Julia, there is a package that calculates derivatives. And it calculates derivatives, but for that, of course, it needs to have the expression, same as the diff command in Mathematica. So then this is called a macro in Julia, and the macro gets as input the expression, not the value of the expression, and then it can do that. So in principle, we could here write something where we then scan the syntax tree and look for x's, and x gets replaced by 1, constant gets replaced by 0, and so on and so forth. Apply the product rule and calculate derivatives. So this is the same basic core that is there in Mathematica as well. Oh yeah, everything in Julia has a type, so we can also calculate the type of this expression, and the type of the expression is called expression, and there's also a dump command, which actually outputs the expression in a bit more of a low-level form. So we saw an expression has two values, there's a head and the arguments, and that's the same as you would get in Mathematica. If you have an expression in Mathematica and you use the square brackets, then 0 is the head and the other ones are the arguments that you get here. So the head is symbol call, that means this expression x plus 2 is a function call, and the first argument is the name of the function. The name of the function is plus because it's an addition, and the other two arguments are x and 2. X happens to be a symbol and 2 is an integer that I added here. Okay. I don't think I want to go any further here in this introduction, but there are packages where people essentially try to replicate certain functionality from Mathematica and make that available as well, similar to SymPy in Python. Okay, let's define a function in Julia. Functions. Let's define a function. What should our function do? Okay, let's do something very simple. Let's write function f of x, and it should return 2 times x plus 1. And then end at the end, this is a function, and then if we call f of 2 of an integer, we get an integer result. F of 3.0, we get a floating point result, and f of 4m, that's an imaginary number, then we get 1 plus 8m because of u. Yes?
So what's the difference of doing this function and the way that you did it before? The defining the expression?
What do you mean expression?
With the...
This one here?
Yeah.
This was me being fancy and looking at the low-level internals of Julia. This doesn't define a function. So if you just do a regular numerical programming, you would not really care about that, or maybe in the later parts of the course. And this is a regular function definition here. This is the same you define a function in Fortran or in Python. In Python would be def f and a colon and so on. There's also a shortcut for defining a function. You can write g of x equals 2x plus 1. So if you multiply with a constant, you don't need the multiplication operator. And then, of course, g of 2 is also 5. And when you define a function, I mentioned types earlier. For example, I can now call the function f also with a string, hello. And that would not make sense, of course, because, yeah, we are trying to add to your multiplication and addition, it doesn't work. What is happening now? Anyway, we're getting an error message, very good. And the error message happens somewhere in the function. So we can, when we define the function, put a type constraint on the arguments so that we only accept numbers. So function f of x number, I hope I'm getting it right. Now it remembers the earlier definition of f as well. So I'm going to ignore that, call it f2. There's only one f2. And then if I call f2 with a complex number, 1 plus 2m, then I get 3 plus 4m. And if I call f2 of hello, I get an error message right away. The previous error came from the interior of the function because it tried to add the string to 1 and something internally went wrong. Right near, it tells me right away, I cannot call f2 with a string. It's a cleaner error message, and that catches the error earlier, and there's a lot of advantage if you have a larger program. If you have just a short script where you do a bit of data analysis, 10, 20 lines, none of this matters. But if you have a larger package where you want to do something, then it's an important thing that errors get caught as early as possible and as concisely as possible, because that points you to where the problem actually is.
Can we clear one of the definitions that made?
No. Oh, that we can do, yeah. If you program something, there's often something that you have a wrong definition somewhere, you want to get rid of it, and you can do that. You can restart the kernel and run everything again. I don't want to do that today, because we did a lot of other things in the end, but whenever you write your own Jupyter Hub notebook, no matter for what language, Python or C or something, it's always a good idea to write the notebook in such a way that you can restart it again from the beginning and then have a clean result. Otherwise, you change something up, change something down, get yourself confused and so on. So I'm not going to do that today, but if you hand in some homework or something, then of course I'm going to run your homework and I'm going to run it top to bottom so you want to see that it actually works the way as expected. Let's also define some types. In Julia, this is now something that, sorry, trying to do markdown here. Types are defined with a struct command. So let's define a struct point. And it has two elements, x and y. And if I create a point with 1 and 2, then the result is a point with the elements 1 and 2. And we can now write a function that accepts, say, points as arguments. Point add p point q point. And then we create a new point, p dot x plus q dot x, p dot y plus q dot y. And then we call point add point 1, 2, and point 3, comma 4, and get 4, point, comma 6. And that, of course, is a bit tedious that I have to write point add to add 2 points to each other. It would be much nicer if I could use the regular plus operator to add points, and that is also possible. You have to write base.plus when you define the function. And then I'm going to use the same thing here. What is wrong? Like this? Yes, got the syntax wrong, sorry. And then I can use the regular addition syntax to add points to each other, which makes sense since points form a vector space. And if you define your own points and if you define the respective operations on them, that's a convenient way to deal with them. Okay, can I get a show of hands? Who of you is currently using a Jupyter Hub notebook to follow on? And who is following on blindly because it's not working? So who of you is currently typing into the Jupyter Hub notebook? It's about half, two-thirds or something. Not bad. Am I going too fast for you? Is the speed fine? too slow, too boring. Mm. Okay, I'll give you a minute or something to catch up, and then we'll begin with a bit of a more complicated topic, namely generic programming or parametricity, which is one of the powers of Julia that you find as well, for example, in C++, but you don't find it in C, Fortran, or Python. Mm.
Can you unpack that base syntax for us?
This one here? Ah, yes, very good. So the regular addition operator is defined in a package called base. The base package is always available. And functions in Julia have several methods. And the function methods are distinguished by the types that they accept. And the regular base plus would accept int and float 64 and then complex and so on and so forth. And what we have here is we're adding a new method to base. And since if we're just calling the plus operation, we just type plus. But if you're adding a new method, because you want to make sure that you add it to the right one, we write base.plus. And in older versions of Julia, you didn't need the colon, but right now you need the colon because plus is a strange function name. So colon plus means the symbol plus, and it's the same syntax as before. And then we're adding a new method to that. And oh, there's also a function called methods. That's called methods plus, that should select base.plus. And then we get all the methods that are known for the plus function. And there are 251 of them, because many things in Julia get added, right? I mean, everything is a vector space, essentially. There's bools, floats, complex numbers, big integers, big float, dates, times, and so on and so forth. Oh, look, there's a plus function that takes only a single argument that works as well, right? That is just the identity function. Like minus of one thing gives you the negative, plus of something gives you the positive.
When you add something to base, is it in there forever then?
No. This is in there as long as the kernel is running.
Okay.
If I restart the kernel, it goes away. If you want to add something forever, then you need to write your own module. And then if you want to use it, you need to be using that module. I don't want to show that today, but on Thursday I can show you how to write your own module because, well, yeah, it is just, yeah.
Complex.
Yeah, so in Julia, I mean, you have kind of a hierarchy of numbers, right? That there are real numbers and then there are integers. And really, really simple integers are kind of Boolean numbers. They can only represent 0 and 1. And complex numbers, you can complexify many rings, I guess, right? Float 64 int, and you can also complexify the Booleans. And Julia decided to do it that way. It's kind of a trick, because then if you write, say, I am, the constant I am, which is, of course, the imaginary unit, and look at the type, this complex bool, because it's just one I am, right? So 0 and 1 fit into the Boolean ring, so to say. So that is nice. And then it's automatically converted to whatever ring you actually need. So you add im to 1, you get an integer. If you add it to big int, you get something else. Oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot. There's something I wanted to mention. If you, for example, have integers, of course, they can only have a certain number of digits, I don't know, 20 or something. So if you calculate 10 to the 30th, you get a number like that. That is clearly not 10 to the 30th. Because you get integer overflow. But Julia has arbitrarily large integers. You can write big of 10, that's a big integer, and then you get the result that you actually expect. Integers are fast, big integers, you need to use those if you have need more precision. And there's also something if you use floating point numbers, for example, 10.0 to the 30th works fine, but if you call that to the 3000th power, you get infinity, because the floating point numbers in Julia that they only have a certain maximum number, and they've been extended with positive, negative, infinity, and so on, so you get infinity. But you can also write big of 10.0, that is an arbitrary precision. Sorry, no, I think it has about 80 bits of precision. And then it actually, yeah. Oh, look, there's a little 4 here at the end, because you still get round off, of course, right? Apparently it's not good enough. And then to the 3000th power, yeah. There's a way to change the precision of the big float numbers in Julia. Is it set precision? Yeah, there's a set precision. Let's just set it to 3000, that precision. Is it no exclamation mark? There you go. And let's do the same thing again. There's still one of those there. Okay, 4,000. There's still something there. I don't know. This is really weird. Maybe it's an artifact or converting the internal binary representation to decibel. Yeah. Anyway, you can get arbitrary precision numbers. And a number like pi is, well, let's look at the type of pi. The type of pi is irrational, so it's kind of a special type built in. And pi is not stored as a floating point number internally. Only when you use it in a certain context, it converts to actually to do that. So if you convert pi to a floating point number, then you get the usual 15 digits or something. But if you convert pi to a big float, then you get the 4,000 digits or something that I actually requested. Mm.
But how can I define other irrationals?
Pardon?
How can I define other irrationals?
Well, there are kind of two or three others defined. There's e and log 2 or something. But each irrational number has its own special definition. So there's no field of irrational numbers. It's a few irrational constants that are known.
Yeah.
That's all.
If I want to define some new irrationals, I mean, why should I do that?
So you can look up the documentation for irrational, and you hope that the user's guide explains how to do that. It's a special thing. I mean, it's not something that a beginner would do at the end. Okay. And finally, I wanted to mention rational numbers that are also really interesting.
Yeah.
Because, of course, they're also arbitrarily exact. If you calculate 1 divided by 1 by 3, is it 1 by 3 times 3? How does it go? 1 by 10? Yeah. If you calculate 1 over 10, then of course the result is not exact because internally it uses a binary representation, and 1 over 10 is not a round number in a binary representation. And of course, if you use rational numbers instead, then that is arbitrarily exact. So if you want to get rid of floating point round off, then you can use rational numbers. And one of the advantages of Julia is that a lot of built-in functions work with arbitrary types. So for example, if you multiply two matrices, and in most languages, it has to be double or single precision, or one of the complex precisions. But in Julia, you can multiply matrices of rational numbers, and then you have no floating point round off. I mean, it's slower, but it's exact, same as in Mathematica. Oof. 1, 2, 3, 4 divided by 10. It's an array of rational numbers. And what? Let's look at the inverse of that. And then you get another array of rational numbers. And that is quite an advantage. So I myself interested in solving Einstein equations and so on. Of course, I need really fast codes. So I don't use rational numbers. But if I want to test something, if I want to test the routine I wrote, I might use rational numbers because then I can test whether things are working without floating point round off. That is a quite convenient thing to have. Okay, and what I wanted to describe today in the remaining 25 minutes or so is how this generic programming works in Julia. Generic programming means that you write code and you don't choose the actual types that you're working as you write the code, but rather you keep it generic. And that means you can use the same code later on with integers, rationals, floating point numbers, and so on. And let's do that. Generic programming. So when you write a function, let's write an add function. Function add that adds two numbers. I could just write x and y, and it would accept arbitrary x's. And then now I require that x and y are of both of a type t. And it looks like this. And that means t is an arbitrary type, or I can say t must be a subtype of all the numeric types. T must be some kind of number, integer, real number, complex number, rational, and so on. And that means in this add function, x and y both must have the same type. And this type must be a subtype of number. Yeah, and I have two add functions again, sorry. Let's just write add two that I have only one method. And then I write add two, 3, 4. And wait.
What is this where curly bracket t blah blah blah?
This defines t, what t is. So t is a type. As I write this function, it is completely unknown what t is. So t is a type variable. It's not a variable that will hold a value at runtime. It is a variable that will hold a type at runtime. And just so that the compiler knows that you didn't type t by accident, you have to declare t. And that shows this syntax, where you have where t at the end. In C++, you would write template type name t in the beginning when you wanted to do that. And this declares t. T must be a number. That's something that means you can't make a string. And then both arguments must have that type t. And when you call the function, then the compiler will look at your call and will determine what t is and will then compile a version of that function for that t. So we have two. Yes?
Could you do things like restrict t, like that where t is a number that's less than 10 or something like that?
No, you can't do that. You could define your own type and then include some mechanisms that check at runtime that everything is less than 10. But that is a more complicated thing to do. But for example, you could say the t must be an integral type, not the number, or t must be a, pardon?
Even?
No, you can't really restrict the values. It's more like the types that you're getting here. Yeah.
If you add 3 and 4.0, it will give you an error message.
Yes. Yes, you do. Very good. Exactly. Because x and y must be the same type. So if I wanted to be more fancy for this add function, I could define type promotion. I'm not going to go into that, but there's a chapter in the Julia documentation. When you pass an integer and a real number, then it looks at the type, one integer and one real, and then it defines what the common type should be, probably real, and then it converts the integer to the real number, and then it calls the corresponding add to function for real numbers. This is how type promotion works. And if you actually call the regular plus operation for Julia, this is also how it works. This type promotion is defined in the language. But I don't want to do that here. I want to show you this generic programming with particular types t here. And the advantage is, if you do it like that, then what you defined is technically not one function, but a family of functions, an infinite set of functions, one for each value of t. And what Julia does, it compiles them separately. So there are two compiled functions available now. And each of them, of course, has been optimized for the respective type. Let's look at that. Code native. This, if it works, gives you actually the machine instruction. I don't know whether it's useful. Add 2, 1, 2. And this shows the native function for the code. If you add two integers, and you see there's one function, this LEAQ is actually an integer add function, and then return. So this is really a really short function, just one machine instruction, very efficient. And if you look at the code for adding real numbers, then you get this VADSD. It's also a very efficient instruction to add to floating point numbers. And we can also see what happens when we add complex numbers. And you see, interesting. It uses a parallel add operation, and this parallel add operation can add two numbers at the same time. Because we're adding one complex number, which consists of two real numbers, so they're added at the same time. And, yes?
Yeah, so I was trying to play with complex numbers, and it's doing something that I don't understand. So if I ask him to add 2 plus imaginary with 3 imaginary, then it gives me a result. But if that 2 I make it a float, it doesn't give me a result.
With this add 2 function?
Yes.
And okay. Both arguments need to have the same type. So what did you type? Can you show me?
I typed 2 plus m.
Like this?
Yes.
Okay.
3m. Like a purely imaginary number. And that is fine.
Yes.
If I make that 2 a float, it's not fine anymore.
Like this?
Yes.
Yes, this does not work.
Okay.
The result of the left expression here is complex float 64. We can just look at it, which is the complexified real numbers.
Yeah.
And type of 3m is the complexified integers.
Oh, okay.
So the solution is to make sure that the right number is also an integer. But of course, the real solution is to define type promotion the way I declared before, because that would be much easier to use. But the goal of that demonstration here is not to make it easier to use, but rather how to define functions in that way. And there is one particular type. What is it called? Is it called any? It's probably any. Yes, there's one type any. Any is a supertype of every type. So earlier I said T number or something, and I could also write T is a subtype of any, and that is always true, because any type is a subtype of that. And
a number or like string or anything?
Anything. Any is anything.
With the two inputs still have to be of the same type, whatever type.
Yes, exactly. That's still, yes. And actually, let's just do something fun. Supertype of int is signed. So signed is all that signed integers types are called signed. So let's look at the supertype of signed. Supertype of signed is integer. That's all the integers, including the big integers. And whatever precision they have, 128 bits. The supertype of integer is real, and the supertype of real is number, and the supertype of number is any, and the supertype of any is any again. And you can look at the subtypes of signed. It gives you all the signed integer types. There are six. And the subtypes of int 64. There are no subtypes of int 64. So all the types in Julia, they form a hierarchy, and you can choose whatever you want here. Now, I showed you earlier generic programming, parametricity, when you define a function. That's kind of easier to understand. I also want you to show how to use it with data types that you defined. Earlier, we had defined a point data type, and that had two floating point elements. Let's see whether I could briefly scroll up. Might not remember it. Where was it? I defined a struct point with two floating point members. You can also make this generic. Well, I don't want to use the point thing again. Let's call it point G for generic or something, which takes an argument of type T, or maybe T, again, a subtype of number. I don't know. Can you subtypes here? You'll see. That seems to work. And now I defined not one type, but again, a family of types. Yes? Mm.
Sorry, I think I missed it, but what's the difference between int and integer?
Int is a particular type, by default, a 64-bit integer. But integer is all the integer types that are available.
Oh, yes.
And, okay, it's the Booleans and the signed integers and the unsigned integers. And if you look at all the signed integers, there were six of these, and probably also unsigned integers. So it's just that if you see it needs to be an integer type, but you don't care about what precision. So we have this type here, and then we can write point G, say, of int 1,2. And we can write point G of what float 64, 1.0, 2.0. And then we have a different point type that can handle floating point values. And one of the huge advantages of Julia over Python, actually, this is probably the source that makes Julia 10 times faster than Python for certain operations, is that the type, the representation of the type, if you write point of float 64, it knows exactly that there are floating point numbers in there. So if you pass this to a function, it knows that there are floating point numbers in there, and it can generate the most efficient machine code for that. If you defined your own point type in Python, then you would say, well, it's a class, it has two members, and then every time this object is accessed, the compiler, the interpreter would need to check what type actually is there. Is it a floating point number? Is it an integer? And that inhibits the optimizations. So if you want to see the advantage of Julia, and I don't know, half of you probably don't care about that yet, then these parameterized types are one of the most important parts. And that also allows you to, for example, define complex numbers in Julia, because they're defined exactly like that. Well, not point G, but complex. And then you get the most efficient machine code. Whereas if you were to define complex numbers in Python, then it would be difficult to get the same speed, which is why complex numbers in Python are built into the language. Whereas in Julia, it's not built into the language. It's just built into one of the base libraries. You can also call point G directly without specifying a type, and then it looks at the arguments and and figures out that this would be 0.64.
Sorry, what is this point G doing?
So point G is a defined, and I called it G for generic, because it's generic. It has one argument T, a type argument, and it has two fields, and both fields are of type T. I defined another point before where I said, oh, both fields are float 64. But maybe you don't want to say it needs to be float 64. Maybe you want to keep your options open for later and say it just needs to be some kind of number. Then it could be float 32, big float, or other things. And this is how you then define something generic, a generic type. So the type point G kind of takes another type as input. So in a way, it's a function that maps types to types. Instead of, I mean, a real function, not a regular function would map a value to a value. Here it maps a type to a type. So in C++, this would be a type template.
Would it give me the largest possible set, the largest possible type? If I don't specify the type, it would return.
So if you just type point G, then you can't actually create an object of the type. You always need to say what you want. But you can, of course, write point G of any. Oh no, I can't, because I said it needs to be a number. So I can't actually, yeah. I should not have done that. Let's remove that. It won't work, because Julia doesn't let me redefine types. It's going to point G2. I'm sorry about that. And then I can write point G2 any works. I can also write, of course, point T2. Hello world, and then I have a point of strings, which I don't know. Might not make sense, but since I didn't restrict G, I can create that type here. Okay. You look a bit puzzled. You don't know where I'm going.
I just don't get the point of what she was doing.
That's a
good
pun.
I don't get the point.
Okay, I don't want to explain it again, because I just explained it. Does someone of you want to explain it again? No, it's not. I don't want to explain it again, because it's not worth explaining. It's very much worth explaining. But if I repeat it, I might explain it in the same way again. That's not useful. So Dustin, do you want to take a shot, or someone else of you? Well, what's the point of this generic programming?
So by having a type, things go faster, right? So if the compiler knows how to use that thing. And here what he's doing is he's inventing a type that can take an arbitrary input as its type and gives you that type of thing. So it gives you a point type of thing, but it can take arbitrary type things as inputs. So it can say two integers or two complex numbers, and it'll give you a point G2 with both entries of type integer.
Maybe I should have expanded next week when you have a bit more programming experience. Maybe we should get back to that in 4 or 5 weeks or so when we see how that is actually useful. Okay. I thought it's an important part of the language, which is why I tried to explain it. Okay. Yeah, sorry. No, they're just discussing.
If you look at line 120, so point G2 has two input or two
can we do it?
Input or whatever, x and y. So in
yeah, it has two fields, x and y. Yes.
So in the bracket, we can put two fields. What happens if we add extra field or only in not add extra field, but in the bracket in like 1 line 138, if you only have one variable or
okay. Sorry, in what line do you want to add something?
In line 113, put 113.
Sorry, let me just clean up the code and then we can go there. Okay, what line?
So, input 113.
113. Oh, I jumped. Yes, here.
So, only one value or one variable.
Oh, you want me to like that?
Yeah.
It's an error message because the type, sorry, the struct has two fields.
Yeah.
When you construct an object of the type, you need to pass both values in there. Yeah. Yeah. Now you can define your own constructor for types. I didn't show that. And then you can write an arbitrary function how to construct things. And there's a nice chapter in the documentation about that. But I don't think I have time today to explain that. Maybe Thursday.
It's hard to hear about
it. Yes.
So in teaching, my main pain point is visualization of data. So,
yes.
So does Julia have advantages as far as that goes over Python, for example?
So I want to be careful there, because you saw how long it took to visualize something in the beginning. And this is one of the big problems with the Julia language. I mean, it's a technical problem. It can totally, right? If you start a web browser, it works right away, right? There's no 10 seconds until the page actually works, although it's written in JavaScript and everything needs loading and so on. So Julia will do the same thing. But at the moment, whenever you visualize something, you have that startup minute there. So I'd say maybe next year or something.
So, but I'm not so worried about that minute as like the functionality of the visualization. Are the packages better, or are they the same?
I think they're about the same. And one of the most widely used packages in Julia is called pyplot, which is matplotlib. So that tells me that it's about the same, probably not much better, but also not worse, because you just call pyplot and you get the same functionality there. So if you need to write a function that processes the data, then in Python, you would probably use something like NumPy or something, or maybe pandas sitting on top of NumPy. And there's a thing equivalent to pandas in Julia. I think it's about the same thing. But if you write a low-level function that does something in Python that needs to touch each element, and you kind of iterate over the element, that is the thing that would be slow in Python. You might, I don't know, if you familiar with NumPy, you know you need to vectorize your code, work on vectors, and so on. In Julia, it's the opposite way. If you vectorize the code, you get the same speed as Python, but if you don't vectorize your code, you get another factor of performance that is impossible to get from Python. And this is, I mean, I'm just trying to sell you the performance of Julia. It might not be worthwhile, because if you're having large data sets, you probably need to read them from disk or something, or downsample, and then the processing speed isn't really important. Julia has communities, Julia visualization, and maybe there is Julia plots actually. There's a community that gives you an introduction and an ecosystem that shows you all the packages that are available in Julia and whatever you can do here. What is this? Statsplots. Okay. Statsplots is apparently also a nice package that you can use for statistics. Ooh, animations are possible. Yeah, there's some JavaScript running in the background. And so on and so forth. Julia ML, there's of course a machine learning community, but it should be true, the Python machine learning community is at least an order of magnitude larger than Julia. So I'm not trying to sell that here. And there was a point I was trying to make about 30 seconds ago, but that forgot what I was going to say. Okay, very good. So what we did today is I gave an Gesundheit. I gave an introduction to Julia language, and I got most of you started on using Julia on symmetry. That's always a bit unstructured the first time of a class like that. The next lectures will be much more structured, I hope. We are going to meet Thursday, not Wednesday. That is just this week. And if you were not able to use Julia today, then please stay here, or I don't know, there might be another lecture here. In that case, we can meet elsewhere. And you can also come to Dustin or my office, Office 350, where we'll help you up, out, get started in Julia. And make sure it works on your laptops or on symmetry.
When would the first assignment be out for this first module?
The,
not that I have any sort of rush. I'm just trying to...
Yes. So what I did 2 years ago was the course consists of modules. Each module is 2 or 3 weeks long. The assignments are kind of described during the module, but we can't really flesh them out until the module is over.
Okay.
And after the end of the module, you have 2 weeks to hand it in.
Thank you.
And yes, thanks for the reminder. If you want to take the course for credit, please tell me. I don't have the list from the university yet. I want to get the list of your names so that I know who needs the credit in the end. And then we can also talk about how to present. Because if there are, whatever, 5 presentations during the class, that might be boring. So maybe you want to meet with an extra time if it's possible, or see some other way. And next week, you're also going to learn how to use GitHub and how to do the collaborative programming. And all the assignments will need to be presented in GitHub as a project like that. OK, that concludes the class for today. See you on Thursday.